This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The U.S. Justice Department announced criminal charges against Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, another militant in connection with the October 7th rampage in Israel.
For financing and directing a decades-long campaign to murder American citizens and endanger the security of the United States.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Tuesday the charges are just one part of the effort to target every aspect of Hamas operations, and he said the actions would not be the last. The World Health Organization said Tuesday after its first 2 days, it was ahead of its target for polio vaccinations in Gaza and had inoculated about a quarter of children under the age of 10 in the enclave. VOA's Jeff Custer with more.
The polio campaign, which had been sped up after the discovery of the first polio case in a Gazan baby last week, relies on daily 8-hour pauses in fighting between Israel and Hamas militants in specific areas of the besieged enclave. Speaking to reporters in Geneva remotely, WHO representative for the occupied Palestinian territories, Rick Piepercorn, said the campaign's first 2 days were excellent.
So the total number of the first 2 days, children under 10, reached 161,030 children. We had an estimate there would be like 156,500 children in this central zones.
Piepercorn said health teams will move into southern Gaza later this week where they are seeking to reach some 340,000 children. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Officials say that a boat carrying migrants is ripped apart in the English Channel as they tried to reach Britain from northern France, and 12 are dead. Dozens of people were plunged into the treacherous waterway, and many did not have life preservers. The Interior Minister, Gerald Darmanin, says that most were believed to be women, some under the age of 18. One official calls it the deadliest migrant accident in the Channel this year. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said two ballistic missiles blasted a military academy and nearby hospital on Tuesday, in Ukraine, killing more than 50 people, wounding more than 200 others. Details from AP correspondent Charles de la Desma.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says two Russian ballistic missiles struck an educational facility and nearby hospital in central eastern Ukraine, killing over 40 people and wounding around 180 others. The strike occurred in the city of Poltava, the capital of the region of the same name. It lies 70 miles from the Russian border. In a video, Zelensky says one of the buildings of the Institute of Communications was partially destroyed. People found themselves under the rubble, but many were saved. The strike appears to be one of the deadliest carried out by Russian forces since the war began. I'm Charles de la Desma.
A bus crashed into a group of students and their parents at a school in eastern China early Tuesday, killing 11 people, injuring 13, according to police. Students and parents were at the gate of the middle school in the eastern province of Shandong just before 7:30 in the morning. That's according to the Dongping County Police Department. Six parents and five kids were killed. One of the injured was in serious condition while the others were listed as stable. The driver was in police custody and an incident was under investigation. A former New York governor's aide has been arrested and accused of secretly working for China. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
Linda Sun, a former aide to New York Governor Kathy Hochul, was charged with secretly acting as an agent of the Chinese government in exchange for millions of dollars in compensation and gifts. Both Sun and her husband, Chris Hu, were arrested Tuesday morning. Each pleaded not guilty to the criminal charges. Federal prosecutors in Brooklyn said that while working in state government, Sun blocked representatives of the Taiwanese government from meeting with officials and sought to arrange for a high-level New York State official to visit China. In exchange, Chinese government representatives allegedly arranged for millions of dollars in transactions for Sun's husband, who had business activities in China.
That is Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reporting. Pope Francis is opening his visit to Indonesia with a packed first day meeting political and religious leaders. His first order of business Wednesday was a meeting at the presidential palace with the Indonesian president, Joko Widodo. He then followed that with opening remarks before government authorities and the diplomatic corps. There, Francis was expected to press his hopes for continued interfaith harmony in a country with a new tiny Catholic minority and world's largest Muslim population. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tom McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The 2024 Forum on China-Africa Cooperation begins today, Wednesday, in Beijing.
I think Africa wants many things. At the top of the list will be some type of debt relief, because Africa owes China a lot of money, and it's becoming clear that many of our countries can no longer carry the debt burden and also do development planning at the same time.
Nigeria struggles to supply gasoline to consumers. Botswana plans to hold election on October 30th as President Masisi seeks another term in office. An attempted jailbreak from Democratic Republic of Congo's largest prison leaves at least 129 people dead. In Uganda, three semi-naked anti-corruption protesters are jailed. Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine is hospitalized following a scuffle with the police.
I'm at the hospital with him now. The doctors say he's out of danger. They stabilized him and all of that. But there are fragments that are still embedded in his leg. A surgery is going to be conducted to remove them.
And Donald Trump and Kamala Harris campaign on the economy while preparing for their first debate. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The 2024 Forum on China-Africa Cooperation begins today, Wednesday, in Beijing. Heads of state and government of Africa's 54 countries are expected to attend. The summit comes at a time when most African countries are looking for bilateral loans, infrastructure development, and technology cooperation, while China is looking for partners and raw materials. Kweku Nuoma is a professor in the School of International Service at American University in Washington, D.C. He tells me that the gathering presents an opportunity for African governments to get what they want and vice versa.
I think Africa wants many things. At the top of the list will be some type of debt relief, because Africa owes China a lot of money, and it's becoming clear that many of our countries can no longer carry the debt burden and also do development planning at the same time. So some type of relief from China would be at the top of the list. But also, there were promises that were made the last time Africa met China in this format that have not been delivered. Then there's also things that China wants that Africa may not be fully comfortable with delivering. So you're going to have to negotiate over those things as well. But these types of events, I would say they are net positive, because anytime you have a chance to engage a major power, you should always take that meeting, but you should always show up with a list of your own demands.
So, Professor, as you said, Africa wants debt relief. I was reading an article by Reuters that says that Chinese lending to Africa rose last year, 2023. What is the difference between China lending and that of, say, the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund?
So the World Bank, as a multilateral lender, usually works with these countries to plan long-term development. And also, they've given us money that we've used to pay off other debts. The Chinese have engaged in more of some kind of a bilateral deal. A lot of it is opaque, so we don't even know how much money governments are borrowing. The Chinese notoriously have a tendency to demand some of the things that we know guarantee a good governance and accountability. They tend not to comment about, you know, whether you rig elections, whether you commit human rights violations, all those things. And we do know that in countries where governance is not taken seriously, leaders are likely to also misuse the money.
Most of those African countries are badly in need of infrastructure development. Loans, can they give up something that they have so that they can get Chinese help with infrastructure development?
Well, some of the deals have involved guaranteeing the Chinese access to Africa's natural resources. So if you look at the DRC, for example, they signed deals that gives China what China wants. China's been looking for raw material, oil and rare earth minerals, for example. And Africa has some of those. But the type of deals that you sign matter. So are you giving them access to the raw form of the resource, or are you setting up deals that require them to come and process some of that in your country so you can also get jobs for your people? But now China is coming to the table with different needs, because the Chinese have invested heavily in new products, particularly electric cars, for example, and they can't export those cars to the West, because Western countries are shutting up their economies. So China at this conference is now looking for markets in Africa to sell, you know, their EVs and, you know, solar panels and all those things.
Kweku Nuama is the professor in the School of International Service at American University here in Washington, D.C. Botswana, Africa's largest democracy, will hold its general election on October 30th. President Mokgweetsi Masisi announced on Tuesday Masisi will seek a second and final term after his ruling party endorsed his candidacy over the weekend. From Habaruni, Kundise Dube reports.
In a public address, Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi said Botswana will continue with its long-standing principle of holding regular elections. Masisi's ruling Botswana Democratic Party has been in power since independence from Britain in 1966.
The Constitution of the Republic of Botswana mandates that we as a nation hold general elections every 5 years. This is not just a legal obligation, but a fundamental principle that underpins our democracy, a commitment we have honored and will continue to honor in the future.
The president urged voters to turn out in large numbers after previous elections in 2019 experienced voter apathy and low turnout. Out of a target of 80% set by the country's electoral body, the Independent Electoral Commission managed to register only 63% of the eligible voters.
Following the diligent preparations by the Independent Electoral Commission, the general elections will take place on Wednesday, October 30th, 2024. To promote higher voter turnout, I am also pleased to declare both October 30th and October 31st, 2024, as public holidays. I urge all Botswana to embrace this opportunity and vote in significant numbers.
Masisi is seeking a second term, which will be his final one if he is re-elected. The president is allowed 2 terms in office, according to the constitution. The BDP's main threat is from a coalition of parties, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, or UDC, and the Botswana Congress Party, which has broken away from the opposition alliance. UDC spokesperson Moi Dimwasa says they expected the announcement of the election date to come earlier.
We welcome the date. However, it's regrettable that such an announcement is made in such a short notice. That would have a nice area when the elections announced were advanced.
Wasa says the election should be free and fair after his party alleged rigging in the previous poll, claims that it is dismissed in court. The ruling party also denied them. Leonard Sela, a political analyst at the University of Botswana, says it was only right for the president to make the election date public as concerns over a delay were mounting.
We were going to get worried if it was going to be exposed. Remember, we are talking about a beacon of a shining democracy in Africa. Small things, they matter in terms of when gauging democracy. So issuing writ and saying October 30th, we are under that track.
In the previous election, the BDP secured a comfortable victory, where its share of the popular vote increased from 47% in 2014 to 53% 5 years later. Mqondisi Dube, VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
Uganda opposition leader Robert Jakulayi Komolenua's Bobi Wine was seriously injured in what the opposition claims is political persecution aimed at intimidating its supporters. The Uganda police denied allegations of a witch hunt and said they were trying to disperse a crowd that was following Bobi Wine. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Uganda opposition leader Bobi Wine was hit by a known substance, according to police spokesman Rusoke Chituma. Bobi Wine was reportedly returning from private function at the residence of the National Unity Platform party lawyer in Wakiso District, which borders the capital Kampala.
When he left them, he and his team moved out of their vehicles and embarked on a procession to Bulindo Town. However, the police advised against it. Despite their guidance, it is alleged by our officers that he insisted on proceeding and closing the road, leading to their intervention to prevent that procession. And during the ensuing altercation, it is alleged that he sustained injuries.
Rusoke says preliminary investigation indicate that Bobi Wine stumbled while getting to his vehicle, which aggravated his injuries.
Social media videos circulated after the incident indicate there was a use of tear gas and gunshots as the police tried to disperse the crowd that was following Bobi Wine. In the videos, he emerged bleeding and limping before he was rushed to the hospital by party supporters. Joel Senyi, the NUP spokesman and the leader of the opposition in the parliament, refutes the police claims they were not involved. Senyi tells viewers James Bate by phone that Bobi Wine was directly shot at with a tear gas canister by the police.
You know, they're like stun grenades of sorts. So it hit him and exploded. So his vans and fragments got therein. Of course, he was rushed to hospital and all of that. What the doctors are telling us, because I'm at the hospital with him now, the doctors say he's out of danger. They've stabilized him and all of that. But there are fragments that are still embedded in his leg. A surgery is going to be conducted to remove them. But very sadly, I've seen an official statement released by police saying he was getting into his car, so he stumbled and fell. I thought, how ridiculous, really. Even when you're trying to tell a lie, be smart about it. It's very unfortunate, it's very shameful that this regime, nearly 40 years old, its only response to peaceful citizens is brutality.
Nkunyinji Muwada is a member of parliament and shadow minister of foreign affairs. He calls Tuesday's incident political persecution aimed at intimidating supporters.
Even as I speak now, our party offices have been now blocked and sealed off tonight. So the attack on President Chagwan is not an isolated instance for only one day. It has been pre-planned over time because the regime thinks and view him as a threat.
Bobi Wine, a former popular musician, emerged as Uganda's lead opposition figure after polling 35% in disputed 2021 presidential election. Felix Motebi, a party supporter, says he will continue his support despite what he calls intimidation from the state.
I think the government is targeting us because of the support, the love that our president has. We are not going to back down. We are going to keep fighting for the next generation.
Several reports have accused the Uganda police as top violators of human rights in the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barkley in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 4th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. An attempted jailbreak from the Democratic Republic of Congo's largest prison has left at least 129 people dead and led to women being raped, the interior minister said on Tuesday. Reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's Lingala service spoke by phone with Emmanuel Cole, a prisoner's rights defender, and the Bill Clinton Foundation for Peace, one of the human rights organizations involved in the DRC.
They were talking about tentative of evasion, but we cannot talk about tentative of evasion whereby people have some refugees from prisons have already escaped from prison. And those who were remained were killed. So we are not talking about temptation of evasion. We talk about evasion and then those who remain were killed. This is what we were supposed to say, because we cannot say where we see a hole. That people, some people passed through, and other people who were trying to attempt, certain of them were killed. And later, people enter in their rooms to kill them innocently. So this is not a matter of people who are attempting to escape, but people who escape. And then they kick the other people who are trying to escape. This is what we have to see.
The government raised the toll of death from 2 yesterday to 129 today, but you were the first to ask for independent investigations, and you said that this number was too low. So what are your thoughts about this toll that the government gave?
The government, the problem is, they told us they want to reduce the number of detainees and the prisoners. But up to now, the figure is not reduced. The figure remains the same. So we are surprising, instead of reducing, now they have to, what I can say, to clear the prison, to free at least more than 10,000 people, so that the prison should become empty for the government to refresh the prison, as the former president Laurent Desire Kabila did.
What do you say about the toll of 129 killed or dead today?
No, this number, well, I cannot doubt of the number, but the figure of the number given, I don't think it's exactly so. It's more than that. So we want international involvement.
Emmanuel Cole is a prisoner's rights defender in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with reporter Eddie Isango of VOA's Lingala service. In Uganda, three semi-naked anti-corruption protesters were remanded at Luzera prison after they staged a protest at parliament. Local media report that the three were arrested while attempting to march through the streets demanding action against alleged corruption. Wilfred Niwigaba is the Ugandan opposition member of parliament and the shadow attorney general. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that the only way to rid Uganda of corruption is regime change.
Well, you see, it's not that it has increased, because ever since President Museveni came to power, his regime has been associated with corruption. But I think what has increased is the citizens' awareness about corruption and its effects.
And what do you make of the response by arresting peaceful protesters who are protesting corruption?
Yes, because you see, that's how this regime particularly is. It reacts against any accusation you make, whether legitimate or not. The regime fit by when the citizens are accusing it of corruption. Corruption, it's the real blood of the NRM regime.
And what do you make of the people's representatives not taking this issue seriously? At least it appears they are just neglecting the cries of the people.
You need to know the setup of that parliament. NRM controls more than 70%, and a monkey cannot be a judge in its own cause. So you wouldn't expect much to be made by parliamentarians, because the majority belong to the ruling regime.
Given the desperation, the seeming desperation of the people, especially the youth, how do you see the thing ending up?
Well, sooner that the youth in Uganda are not as courageous as the youth in Kenya. But I cannot encourage them to keep up the fight. But the best fight would be to ensure that there is regime change. It's unfortunate that our law and order enforcement police officers do not want to see a difference between peaceful protests and riots. For them, any protest amounts to a riot. It's unfortunate, but we know they are under command, and the only person who gives the command is the president himself. So I wouldn't even blame the police, but I cannot sympathize with them.
Wilfred Niwigaba is a Ugandan opposition member of parliament and a shadow attorney general. He spoke from Dubai with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. Nigerians are reacting to a recent announcement by the country's state oil firm, the NNPC Limited, that said financial strain is thwarting its ability to import gasoline into Africa's most populous nation. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Barely 48 hours after Nigeria's state-owned oil company made a startling revelation, hundreds of commuters joined a line stretching many kilometers for fuel at an NNPC outlet in the capital. In a statement on Sunday, Nigeria's state oil firm NNPC Limited admitted that financial constraints are hampering its ability to import gasoline. The statement acknowledged local media reports in July that the oil regulator owed oil traders more than $6 billion, double its debt compared to April. Nigeria depends on imports to meet its daily demand for gasoline, more than 66 million liters, and NNPC is the sole importer of fuel. Abuja resident John Prince says he's been waiting in line for hours.
So initially, when I came in the morning, they were not selling. They said they were waiting for order from above. I've been here for the past 2 hours. If I'm not over-exaggerating, there should be up to 500 or 600 cars here.
Prince said that while they waited, the gasoline station reviewed prices upward by nearly 30%. NNPC said the situation could worsen supply in coming days, but also said it is working with the government and partners to fix the problem. Fuel shortages have been recurring in Nigeria since last year, despite Nigerian President Bola Tinubu scrapping the fuel subsidy. Tinubu doubles as petroleum minister, but authorities later reinstated a partial subsidy to curb inflation. The high cost of living and growing public tensions triggered by economic reforms. But the founder of the Center for Transparency Advocacy, Faith Nwadishi, says corruption and incompetence are to blame.
It's just a cocktail of corruption, impunity, and no regard for the people of the country.
Last month, NNPC announced a record $1.9 billion in profits for 2023, but said it was covering for shortfalls in the government's petrol import bill. Meanwhile, authorities say the Dangote oil refinery in the Lagos area has begun gasoline production and could supply up to 25 million liters this month. On Tuesday, the Nigerian Midstream and Downstream Petroleum Regulatory Authority entered an agreement with the NNPC to sell crude oil to Dangote refinery in the local currency, the Naira. If that happens, it could significantly address local supply issues and save the country several billions of dollars in foreign exchange. Timothy Obizu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
With just over 2 months to go before Election Day in the United States, presidential nominees Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are preparing for their first debate and campaigning on the economy. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looked at the state of the race.
Donald Trump is campaigning hard on the economy and on Kamala Harris.
Here's what we know about Comrade Kamala Harris. She just doesn't care about the American people, especially hardworking people or middle-class Americans. She just doesn't give a damn about you.
The Harris campaign says it's Trump who'll hurt working families with tax cuts for corporations.
Building up the middle class will be a defining goal of my presidency.
She'll make groceries more affordable by cracking down on price gouging. And she'll cut housing costs by taking on corporate speculators.
The economy is voters' top issue in this election. That's a problem Harris needs to fix quickly, says political consultant Hank Scheinkopf.
She's got to explain why people are paying what they think is more at the gas pump and why their bread costs as much as it does and why the manufacturers of those products are giving them less for their dollar.
Trump running mate J.D. Vance says voting for Harris means losing more U.S. jobs.
Think of all the powerful interests, the broken bureaucracy in this country, the people who've gotten rich shipping your jobs to China. They want Kamala Harris. The only way to beat him and the only way to fight back is at the ballot box this November.
Harris's running mate Tim Walz says it's Democrats who are committed to U.S. workers.
Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, they have something a little different in mind. The only thing these guys know about working people is how to take advantage of them, how to not pay them. Every single chance they've gotten, they've waged a war on workers and the ability to collectively bargain.
With just over 2 months to go, this is a close race. Most public opinion polls show Harris with a slight lead over Trump nationally. Michigan voter David Martinez backs Trump.
He's a true American patriot. I think that he thinks more about people that live in this country than he does himself. Everything that he does is to try to help somebody.
Georgia voter Becca Rush backs Harris.
You know, it's 2024, and we need some fresh blood, and we need a new brighter future.
While continuing to campaign, Trump and Harris will spend much of the next week preparing for their first presidential debate next Tuesday. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, September 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV show, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.